This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are going to be continuing our look at Quentin Tarantino's filmography with what he considers to be the fifth film by Quentin Tarantino, Death Proof.
Yes, Death Proof.
Yes, now this is another odd situation in a lot of ways because it's only half a movie, maybe?
Technically speaking, yeah.
Originally, this movie came out. It came out in April of 2007 as half of Grindhouse, which was a film, I guess, one film in which Robert Rodriguez directed one movie, Planet Terror, and Quentin Tarantino directed the second movie in the double feature, Death Proof. And yep. In between, there were trailers for fake movies directed by various people, and the idea behind it was to recreate the experience of going to a grindhouse cinema in, say, the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for people who don't know, a grindhouse would be a theater which was usually run down, which would show, you know, usually really, really beat up prints of old exploitation movies, whether they were kung fu movies or, you know, sexploitation movies or horror movies, as is the case here. Yeah. And usually the quality was not tremendously great. And these were the movies which Tarantino and Rodriguez grew up on, the experience which Tarantino and Rodriguez grew up on. And they loved it and wanted to recreate it for modern audiences.
Yeah.
So, okay, now we know that you were, you know, still in a dark place when it came to Tarantino back in 2007. So, I mean, what about Robert Rodriguez? Now, we talked about Rodriguez before with Four Rooms, yeah. And Rodriguez and Tarantino are kind of like brothers in filmmaking. They came up together like the same year, you know, Tarantino had Reservoir Dogs on the festival circuit at the same time that Rodriguez had El Mariachi. And because of that, the two of them have kind of like become a team along the way. And this was their chance to sort of team up again. Now, just the year before, Rodriguez had, or no, I'm sorry, 2 years before, Rodriguez had released Sin City.
Yeah.
And Sin City was interesting, you know, in relation to this series in that the special guest director was Quentin Tarantino. Essentially, Rodriguez had started making movies digitally, and Tarantino was very much still in his film world, and Rodriguez was trying to convince him that digital was the way to go. So in an effort to convince him, he let Tarantino direct one scene from Sin City. It was the scene with Clive Owen and Benicio del Toro in the car. Mm-hmm. So did you see Sin City in the theater?
I did not see it in the theater. Okay. You know, there's a big key difference here because in 2007, I became a dad.
Okay.
Prior to that, I had gotten married, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. So life changes considerably over this span of time here. And as a result, as I recall, at least where I was, Sin City was not an easy movie to get to in the theater. It was one of those things where enough was going on in my life where it came and went before I had the opportunity. I'm a big comic book fan. I'm a big Frank Miller fan. And so regardless of who was directing it, it was going to get me in the theater. But it failed too, just because timing wasn't right. And so, you know, I had nothing against, like when I eventually saw Sin City on home release, I was like, wow, I really, really liked it.
But it wasn't enough for you to sort of overcome your Tarantino hatred or whatever at that point in time and be like, you know what, I'm going to go check out this Grindhouse movie because it sounds like a really cool concept.
I wanted to, desperately. I really legitimately wanted to, but my firstborn daughter was born in February of 2007. So this came out at a time where it was extremely difficult to, with a clear conscience. Like, I'm pretty sure that if I had pushed it, I'd been like, yeah, I'm going to go out to the movies tonight for 3 hours and go watch Grindhouse. But in the back of my mind the whole time, I would have been like, because I'm a colossal jerk who's very self-centered right now. So I had to let it go. So did you see it in the theater?
Yeah, I did. You know, and for me, it was kind of a really big deal. In addition to being like a Tarantino movie coming off of Kill Bill, right? It's also a Rodriguez movie coming off of Sin City, which I absolutely loved. And then the concept for it, you know, it's like it's a double feature. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be all these fake trailers and it's going to have like film scratches and everything. And it's recreating an experience, you know, that time has forgotten. Like that was really appealing to me, especially since it was sort of like a presentation of presentation. Yeah. And at the time I was a projectionist, so I was super curious to see what this would be like. And I was also looking at it with a very critical eye as a projectionist. You know, I imagine in the same way that, you know, doctors look at doctor movies or whatever, you know, and seeing, you know, what makes sense, what doesn't, what's accurate, what's not. And because of that, I was really, really super duper looking forward to it. And, you know, I saw it and then I actually ran it, you know, as a projectionist. And it was a pretty cool experience all the way around, I have to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. So there were the two movies put together. It was this whole experience. It was a really big deal. Everyone thought this was box office gold because Tarantino had just done Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2, which were both very successful. Rodriguez had just done Sin City, which was very successful 2 years before, and that came out on Good Friday of 2005. So I think kind of like piggybacking on that movie's success and everything and sort of trying to find the formula that worked, they decided to release Grindhouse on Good Friday 2007. And everyone thought this would be a massive hit, even though it was 3 hours long. And the reality of the situation was that no one went to see it.
Yes, I seem to recall that it had a fair time finding or a fair amount of trouble finding an audience.
It bombed bad. And as a result, instead of planning like, oh, what's Grindhouse 2 going to be like? Who are we going to get? You know, because the idea was to maybe take a couple of these fake trailers and turn them into real movies, give other people a shot at directing, you know, and make it like a franchise. You know, they had big plans for Grindhouse. And, you know, after opening weekend, they were like, okay, maybe we need to start rethinking these things. And one of the things which had always sort of been intended was to eventually split the movies up and release them as extended cuts, because since the movie is a double feature and you need to keep it down to 3 hours, that means you need to keep both of these movies essentially to under 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And both of them sort of were built to be longer. I mean, Tarantino, as we all know, he's... not exactly brief when it comes to filmmaking.
That's true. That is very true.
So, as much like with Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair, a couple years before, when the Cannes Film Festival was held a month later, Tarantino debuted the feature film director's cut kind of thing, whatever, the single, you know, movie cut of Death Proof. And people liked it. And the strategy became sort of like, it's no longer Grindhouse. Now it's Planet Terror and Death Proof. And when it was released overseas, they were released as separate movies. When they were released on DVD and Blu-ray, they were released as separate movies. Yeah. And it wasn't until years later that they put them back together for a Blu-ray release. So, okay, you saw it originally on home video,
yeah,
as separate films. Which one did you see first?
I didn't see Planet Terror for the first time until last year, actually. So when I was given the choice, you know, Road Diverges in Two Woods, and I went straight for Tarantino, and I said, yeah, okay. Because I'd actually heard from a couple of friends who did manage to see Grindhouse. They said, oh, Death Proof's the better movie. You should watch that one. If you got a choice, choose that one. I said, okay, I'll choose that one. And it underwhelmed me a bit, because I think that the individual release is a bit long in the tooth. The joke goes on a little bit too long. And I don't mean to say that this is done as a joke. I think that one of the beautiful things about it, one of the things that sets this apart for Tarantino, is that he's not just paying homage. Like, I think that there's an identity difference between these two films. As much as I love Planet Terror as its individual, Planet Terror is basically a long gag. It's somebody directing something in the style of something. Whereas Death Proof plays as, what if Tarantino were a director working in these low budget type of situations back then? Like, it's almost like a thought experiment of what would it look like if Quentin Tarantino's career had occurred in the 70s. And I think Death Proof is what you get. And I think that's the real slick brilliance of it. So for this, for the first time, I watched Grindhouse. I got the Blu-ray and I watched them back to back. So I would urge everyone to watch the Grindhouse version of Death Proof as opposed to the individual cut of Death Proof in this case. Well, so you saw it in the theater. You have a completely different experience. Like, when you came out of the theater, did you have a clear favorite as to between the two of them? And then when they did their individual cuts, where did you end up?
Yeah, when I came out of the theater, I mean, I loved both of them. And more so than that, I loved the overall experience. I loved Grindhouse as a complete work, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do think that they definitely had different styles, like you were saying. I mean, like, I was thinking about this today. I really get the impression, that this was Tarantino's idea to begin with, for one thing, because you heard him talk about Grindhouse movies a lot in the years leading up to this. I mean, he talked about how, you know, Kill Bill was an homage to Grindhouse movies and everything. And I feel like he said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we recreated this experience? And he, like, described the experience to Rodriguez, who maybe had some sort of, like, tangential, you know, knowledge of it, but probably didn't, like, sit through these double features in the same way that Tarantino did. That would be my guess. Mm. And Tarantino was like, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And when Rodriguez went off and made the movie, he said, okay, I'm going to do this thing in this style, just like Tarantino said. You know, I'm going to make one of these movies. But when Tarantino came to do it himself, he was sort of like, I'm striving for something more. It was almost like Tarantino came up with the rules but didn't play by them, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. Yes, absolutely I can see that, yeah.
So, you know, I think that in a lot of ways, Planet Terror is a lot more fun. Planet Terror, I think, maybe has some more cohesion in terms of its narrative and everything like that. And I also think that it works better in its short form, because I think that Rodriguez is someone who can understand, like, you know, I need to hit an hour and 20 minutes, I can do that. Whereas I think Tarantino's take with Death Proof was really like, I'm going to make the movie I want to make, and then I'm going to cut it down to whatever I have to cut it down for, and then I'll be able to release the, you know, director's cut by itself later on, which he even said. He's like, you know, cutting it down was really hard, but, you know, knowing that down the road people would see the director's cut is kind of what made it palatable. Whereas I get the impression that with Planet Terror, like, Rodriguez made that theatrical cut, and I really kind of think like he stuck stuff back in order to extend it,
yeah,
and not necessarily because he thought he was making a better movie that way. And because of that, because of those two philosophies, I think when it came time to release the DVDs and everything, Death Proof came out first, like a few months before Planet Terror. Same thing, I think, with the theatrical release overseas when they released it as just one movie, because Tarantino had that extended cut done, whereas I don't think that Rodriguez was ready for it yet. You know, he just, because that's not what his focus was. So, you know, definitely different approaches. In the end, I think that Death Proof is the better movie because I think that it is trying for something more and I think it's succeeding. But like back in 2007, when I made my top 10 list, like Death Proof was number one and Planet Terror was number two.
Okay. See, the thing is, I think that I give a lot of credit. I think that just the editing, having seen both versions now, finally, I think that the editing on Death Proof, the theatrical / Grindhouse, whatever you want, the shorter version of Death Proof is amazing because it actually changes the experience in this fundamental way where I got more out of it watching it in this fashion. I actually felt like, and again, Sally Menke edits this, right?
Yes, she does.
And I think that the true masterful touch here is what it feels like even more than anything else, which I think is brilliant, is it feels like a schlocky movie that there was originally like a first one and a sequel, and then they, you know, and then they went back and they're like, make one movie out of it and we can recoup our costs or something like that. Because because I know you're a fan of gear shift movies, and so hey, it's a car movie and it's a gear shift movie. That's perfect, yeah. Right? But it literally does feel like two different films that got mashed together. And I think the experience is amazing just because it's such a conscious decision. And, you know, the stuff that they cut out and the things that they left out, I think it just moves so much more briskly. And, you know, it just engaged me more this time around. It's really odd, too, because of the fact that we're sitting here talking about Tarantino doing Star Trek, and then Jason Isaacs is in one of the trailers that's between the films. Don't. Like, and that one, my gosh, I laughed. I was like, oh, I know this trailer. You know, like that was, I thought Thanksgiving went a little off the rails. That, you know, like some of the trailers were trailers. Yeah, okay, I could see seeing this and this feels right. And then the other ones were sort of like Planet Terror, where it was like, okay, this is in the style of the way you do. You know, it's like, it's the knowing joke versus the artistry sort of approach to it, I guess. And I think that just, you know, speaks to the difference between the two halves of Grindhouse here. But yeah, I mean, I remember seeing the director's cut, the extended cut of Death Proof. And my whole impression of it was, this is going on too long. This is just not playing particularly well. And I thought also that the way that the color changed in the one, you know, that they have that one switch where it goes to black and white, that felt, that didn't feel genuine. And although I know that like Tarantino, they physically scratch the film for Death Proof. Whereas Rodriguez was, and the thing is, I'm purposely going into this because I've heard you talk about the inaccuracies of Planet Terror's film damage before, and I enjoy it because I think everybody enjoys hearing you talk about this sort of thing. But like, Death Proof's film damage feels authentic, and Planet Terror's does not.
Okay. Well, here's the thing, right? Okay, here's the thing. Here's me putting on my projectionist hat. This is the thing that... Okay, so now, obviously, as we just were talking about with the whole Sin City thing, Tarantino is film all the way, you know, never going to shoot anything digital. It's not going to happen anytime soon, which means that, you know, his Star Trek movie will definitely be shot on film. Whereas Rodriguez is very, very, very much in the mindset that digital is the best thing. I think it was Lucas who convinced him of that. You know, Lucas showed him early tests, and, you know, a bunch of filmmakers, early tests when he was making Episode 2 or whatever, or even before that. And Rodriguez is one of the people who came away from it saying, like, this is amazing. You know, he bought his own digital camera. He used it to shoot Once Upon a Time in Mexico, and he's never gone back. And his whole thing has always been that, you know, you can create any film look with a digital camera. You know, you can just, it's that good. So that's obviously the route that he took when, you know, making Planet Terror. And one of the interesting things about these two movies is both directors shoot the movies themselves. Rodriguez does that all the time anyway, but Tarantino shot Death Proof himself as well. It's the only time he's ever done that. So that's kind of cool. But because of that, because these two people were trying to go for the same effect, but going about it, you know, working independently, essentially, they each went about that look in a different way. Rodriguez decided to shoot digitally and add all of the film grain and all of the film damage in post-production. So much so that, you know, one of the things that they had planned and one of the things that they actually do on the Planet Terror Blu-ray is they have the newly uncovered, cleaned up, you know, restored print of Planet Terror, which you can watch. You can watch the entire movie without the film damage effects added to it.
Interesting.
There's still a few, because a few of them are sort of like baked in, essentially. Whenever there's like an edit, you know, there's a few times where there's like a physical cut in the film and like footage is removed and you see like the splice marks. Those are still there, and the missing reel is still there. But all of the grain and all of the dirt and scratches, they're all removed on this special version of Planet Terror. It's an interesting thing to watch for sure, but obviously the damaged version is the way to go. With Death Proof, what Tarantino decided to do was shoot on film and then actually damage the film.
Yeah.
And then print that damage onto the release prints. Now, I can tell exactly what he did by looking at it, and it drives me up the wall, because like you're saying, right, like it does look like real damage, and it is real damage, but it's not anything that damage caused by a movie theater would look like. Okay. So let's just go back to Planet Terror for a minute. Like, the damage in that is actually pretty good. The dirt looks like dirt. The scratches look like scratches. The edits, you know, like the little like missing footage that's like cut out and spliced together. The effect is fine, although the effect is done for effect and is very convenient as to its placement. And also the thing that no one ever takes into account whenever they have that sort of like splice of missing footage where the film essentially skips. No one ever takes into account the fact that the picture and the sound skip at different points, because basically you've got sound printed on the side of the film, and as the film is going through the projector, it goes through the lens first, but the optical reader for the soundtrack is below the lens. So the film, the sound is actually printed, like, I forget what it is, like 20 frames above the picture, essentially. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you see the visual splice on the screen, and then like a half a second later is when you hear the pop, or, you know, when the sound is missing, you know, the correspond. Anyway, it's just whatever. But But there's that, you know, so, you know, it's convenient. Like, you know, there's, you'll see on prints or whatever that are damaged, you'll see black dirt or black scratches, and you'll see white dirt or white scratches. And those are caused by two different things, essentially. Like, if you see the black dirt and scratches, that's caused by, you know, dirt on the print itself, you know, usually caused by the projectionist, caused by the movie theater. Whereas if it's white, that means it was done at the lab. So very conveniently, this was printed at a very dirty lab because most of the movie takes place at night. So there's a lot of white film damage. And when you see those white, you know, scratches and those white specks of dirt, that means that, you know, it was caused at the lab, and you always see the white stuff during dark scenes, and you always see the black stuff during white scenes, and, you know, whatever. So I can forgive that, because whatever, they wanted to read and, you know, all that stuff. With Tarantino's, they're all actual real damage. However, I think what he did, I'm 99.9% positive what he did, was he took the work print of the movie, which, you know, is going to get banged around, it's going to get thrown, because essentially, you know, I mean, before you would actually be editing the film together, you know, manually, you know, now you do it digitally, but you still assemble a print in order to view. And the thing which really strikes, you know, strikes me, the thing which is very, very obvious on this, is there are splicing tape in between almost every single shot, or sometimes in the middle of a shot. And that's because the individual shots are physically spliced together with tape. Mm-hmm. Projectionists will splice that stuff together. That's what happens, like when they're splicing reels together, or if there is damage and they need to like repair the film, that'll happen. It's not going to happen in between every single shot. And it annoys the crap out of me, because it has no relation to reality in that regard. That really bothers me. And the other thing that really bothers me in both of them, like a lot, like a whole bunch, is the whole missing reel thing, which luckily is gone from the extended cut of Death Proof, which is, I think, if for no other reason, Death Proof is a better movie, because, you know, as the extended cut, because there is no missing reel thing. But it's there in Planet Terror, and clearly it was there for dramatic effect, or in this case, comedic effect, where, you know, that's the reel that, you know, essentially what they're saying is like 20 minutes of the movie is missing, and,
right,
you know, we leave on a love scene, and we come back on like the building on fire, and all of the questions which have been, you know, sort of secretive throughout, you know, they're all revealed, and we never actually get the answers to any of these things, all that stuff. But it annoys me, because especially since it says like missing reel, sorry for the inconvenience, theater management or something like that. That, I think I know where that comes from too. Listening to Tarantino talk, he talks about how, like, because he's a collector of prints, right? And occasionally he'll buy a print which is missing a reel. And he said, like, with one movie, he was, you know, watching it or whatever, and, you know, it was missing a reel, and he realized that that particular movie played a lot better with those 20 minutes gone, you know? And he thought that was a cool thing to put in there. That has absolutely no relation to anything in reality. There is never, ever a movie which just plays an incomplete print, you know, because a reel is missing. They don't have snipes that say reel missing, sorry theater management, or anything like that. It drives me up the wall, because it is so inaccurate that it really does strain any sort of
credibility. Right, it would just jump to the different scene. Like if you couldn't detect. I actually remember one time when Return of the Jedi was re-released in 97, seeing it at a theater in the DC metro area that was very, everybody loved to go to it. It was the Uptown Theater. It was old school, you know, the giant screen. Like it was an old movie palace type of place. I think it's still there, but I'm sure it will be till the end of time. But we went to Return of the Jedi. I went with a couple of friends from college, and we're sitting there and we're watching. And because, of course, I know Return of the Jedi, like it jumped from them getting on the speeder bikes to the, it just jumped to Admiral Piet on the bridge during the battle. And I, you know, I got up and I ran out and I was like, you jumped to the wrong part. And they're like, no, everything's fine. I was like, no, it is not. And I can tell you, you know, and then the movie stops and then screen went out and then like it went back and then it started playing the right thing because they'd fed the wrong reel or something like that. But that's just to, you know, back the point where it's like you wouldn't see scene missing. Like that's almost like a callback to the video for Closer by Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Because that was all throughout that video where it was like scene missing and stuff right. like that. So
which you do see like in, you know, editing, like if you're editing a movie or something like that, especially if it's a visual effects heavy thing, you know, it'd be like effect missing or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
But not in an actual theatrical presentation. But yeah, I don't, that's the one thing which really, really bothers me. The other things I can kind of forgive. But with Death Proof, there's also a weird thing which Tarantino does where that first half, you know, with the first mm-hmm. set of friends, you know, that's all scratched up and everything. But as soon as they, you know, get to Tennessee and we get into the second half with the second group of friends, then the picture is absolutely pristine.
Yeah. And that's what I think is, whether it's intentional or not, it winds up feeling like, you know, a producer had, oh, I have these two movies that nobody wanted to see. Put them together and we'll have one movie that people can go see. And I don't have to spend money on another movie. You know, like I think that's the effect that winds up being created. And I, you know, it works. And what's interesting too, and I was thinking about this while we were rewatching Kill Bill, and I, you know, we're sitting here watching Death Proof and Jackie Brown and everything like that. I think that there is, for Tarantino fans or for people who are fans of film that isn't necessarily the mainstream and everything, of course, a big matter of discussion is, you know, about, you know, more female heroes and stuff like that. Fair, valid discussion. You need, you know, need to expand the focus in, you know, in mainstream entertainment and stuff like that. But I think that sometimes there can be a really weird warping effect for people who watch Tarantino films or other films where there are a lot of strong female characters, where the women do win, where the women are smarter, where the women are, you know, genuinely interesting and well-written characters. I think it winds up being a weird warping effect in the conversation, because you wind up, when you hit this conversation with people where they say, oh, you know, where are the strong female characters, you have in your brain, well, aren't you watching Tarantino? And it winds up being, I think, a weird sort of spin in the brain at times to not be able to realize that, like, your film experience, thanks to filmmakers who have been doing it, can sometimes be skewed. And you know, do you get what I'm trying to go for on that?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think, like, when I, you know, back when these movies were coming out with, you know, Twitter not existing and all that stuff, it was something which I hadn't ever really thought of. You know, I mean, there was sort of the idea that, like, yeah, you know, there's these movies with these strong female characters, and that's certainly one of the things which really appealed to me about them, mm-hmm. something about them that appealed to me. But, you know, obviously it's not the norm. You know, it's something which most movies don't have. And
yeah.
I think about this all the time whenever it comes to, like, you know, thinking about, like, Best Picture, you know, Oscar stuff. And when I'm looking at, like, the best lead actor and the best lead actress, there's way more movies, you know, that have, like, lead actors than lead actresses, in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool that Tarantino has been doing this. And you know, well, Rodriguez with the Planet Terror as well. And, you know, looking at these movies now, you know, this time around, especially, I think, you know, with all the talk about, you know, how there aren't that many, you know, female-centric movies, comparatively speaking, and everything like that, it is interesting. I'm continually impressed by how well these characters are written in these movies, you know, I mean, and just sort of like the way that they're presented, which is not like, you know, check out these awesome you know, women. It's just like, check out these awesome characters.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. The fact that they're women is like incidental.
Yeah. And I think it's really cool. I keep on thinking about, I always think about this, like Tarantino, he took a lot of grief from people back when Kill Bill came out because, you know, they were, he's like, you know, someone said in an interview or something like that, like, what do you think about, you know, kids watching this or whatever? And he's like, oh, I think it would be good for if, you know, girls especially, like young girls especially, went to see it because, you know, they would show them, you know, on equal footing with men and all that stuff. And people are like, what, you want, you know, little kids to see Kill Bill? And he's like, yeah, why not? So I don't know if that's what your plan is with your parenting strategy or whatever, but
I'm probably going to save the Tarantino Film Festival for later. But it is funny okay. that you mentioned how he puts women on equal footing. Because the foot thing definitely continues in Death Proof.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the opening shot, I actually chuckled this time because it comes up and it's like, yep, okay, there we go. We got the feet thing.
For sure.
And I
for
think sure. actually, forgive me for forgetting the name of the actress who plays Butterfly.
Vanessa Ferlito.
Yeah. She has a foot double in the credits.
Oh, does she?
She does. In the okay. credits, it says she has a foot double. And I was like, of course. Why wouldn't he be that finicky about feet? That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. I don't know. I really do love Death Proof. I mean, I love Planet Terror too, but Death Proof, I think, you know, just the idea, and this kind of, you know, people have brought this up when talking about the whole Star Trek thing. Like, obviously, there's a lot of influences everywhere for every movie or whatever, but one of the things which kind of inspired Tarantino to make this movie was his desire to do like a slasher film. And at one point, he had actually toyed with the idea of making a Friday the 13th movie. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he decided that he was better off doing his own thing and making his version of a slasher movie, which, you know, I mean, this is straight up a slasher movie in terms of the structure and everything. The only difference is that, you know, the serial killer isn't using a knife. He's using a car. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really effective in that regard, but it also doubles in this kind of like genre bending, genre mashup way. It doubles as an awesome car racing movie, you know, car chase movie. Yeah,
it does. And I marvel because it's Zoe Bell, and Tarantino even said in the Cannes interview, he's like, I wrote this around her. Yeah. He's like, she makes this all work. And I've never seen, you know, anything since with her, you know, headlining the way she does this or anything like that. But that car stunt scene, you know, where he's ramming them and she's flying around on the roof of the car, I know it all turns out okay. Like, that is, that I think, if anything, winds up being a brilliant testament to, you know, great stunt work. I mean, naturally. But just the fact that I was on the edge of my seat during the whole, you know, car chase scene where he's ramming them and she's on the hood of the car. I know everything turns out okay, spoilers, and all of that stuff. And I'm still on the edge of my seat because it's shot so well and the stunt is so spectacularly done and convincing that I got such a big kick out of it.
Yeah, and that's, for people who don't know, Zoe Bell is a stunt double. She was Uma Thurman's stunt double in Kill Bill, and I think she was also on Xena. I want to say, I could be wrong about that, but regardless, she is, you know, straight up, I mean, that's her day job, is she's a stunt woman. So when it came time to do this movie, Tarantino was like, well, she's very charismatic, she can act, I'm just going to cast her as this character and then have her do her own stunts because that's her job. And, you know, why even have her play someone else? We'll just have her play herself. She is a stunt double. Mm-hmm. who's doing this stuff, and her name is Zoe Bell. So there you go.
That's awesome.
I guess that means, I mean, because these movies, I think, clearly take place in the movie universe that we were talking about last week. But does that mean that Zoe Bell is a real person in the movie universe? I don't know.
Well, it would mean if this plays in the movie universe and Zoe Bell is playing herself, then she's a real person in the movie universe who crosses over. She's one of the crossover characters, because somebody who's in the movie universe would go to see this movie that's in the movie universe, and Zoe Bell therefore could potentially be sitting in the audience with the person that's in the movie universe, not the movie universe.
Yeah, if you want to get really complicated with it, you
and I do.
Till Dawn, clearly a movie. It's got Earl McGraw, it's got all these things. From Dusk Till Dawn is clearly in the movie universe. But there's a documentary about the making of From Dusk Till Dawn called Full Tilt Boogie. So since From Dusk Till Dawn is a movie in the movie universe, which means that the people in the movie universe are watching it, does that mean that Full Tilt Boogie is a movie in the movie universe?
It would have to be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's the only way that it works.
And so it's almost like it's not a documentary. It's part of the Pulp Fiction universe.
Yes.
Yeah. So there is like a Quentin Tarantino and a, you know, Robert Rodriguez and a George Clooney.
You know, people might be chuckling, but I guarantee you there's going to be a college course on this in like 20 years. Maybe less. Maybe 10. Like after he directs a Star Trek movie and he's like, I'm all done with it. They're going to release college classes and we're going to find out. Yeah. It's going to be pretty. Ooh. Yeah, and see, the thing is, of course, it sends me down the road. Of course, Star Trek will be in the movie universe, not the movie universe.
You would think, but then again, he does say, like, he's like, Jackie Brown doesn't take place in either universe. It's in the Elmore Leonard universe. But someone, I think, is smoking red apple cigarettes in there, and they have, a Acuna Brothers or whatever,
During the previews, somebody is drinking soda from the fictional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And place. That's in it. Not only is there a commercial for it, there's also a, you see it in the movie, you see it in, I think, one or the other, Death Proof or Planet Terror, but then you also see it in the food court in Jackie Brown. So it's, I guess we'll see.
But I guess advertising.
It's kind of like, and then if you want to get really complicated, right? I mean, well, you could already say that Star Trek is in the universe because of the old Klingon proverb, but then you bring Slusho into it, right? Mm-hmm. So, which is in, you know, it's in Star Trek 09. So then does that mean Alias and Lost and Heroes and Chuck and all those other shows are in the movie universe?
Right now I'm just picturing, because my brain has sort of broken down, I'm just picturing a Klingon drinking a Slusho while smoking a red apple.
There you go.
And reading an Elmore Leonard novel.
There you go.
You got your opening shot of Quentin Tarantino's Star Trek movie right there. Boom. Done.
There you go. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Death Proof today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
Yeah, that's definitely the case, I think, for sure. Well, in this novel, it's very much about the Klingons and their society, and it's from the perspective for the there's a framing story, basically, in which Captain Kirk starts reading a book called The Final Reflection, which is told from the perspective of the Klingons, and it's ostensibly the book that we are reading here. This is the book that Kirk's reading in this book.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Starts off with a quote. Revenge is a dish that is best served cold, and it's credited as an old Klingon proverb. So,
yeah,
that means that Kill Bill takes place in the Star Trek universe.
To the journey!
I like that they take a two-dimensional movie and watch it in a three-dimensional environment, only to experience it as a two-dimensional image watched in 3D that we are watching at home on a two-dimensional screen. This is meta beyond meta beyond meta.
And he's gone meta again.
You really have gone meta now. My brain just failed completely during that.
Warp 5.
And I think it's one that gets overlooked a lot because of a couple reasons. I think it gets overlooked because it's simply a one-shot episode in season four. And I think it gets overlooked because it seems like a fan service episode for the Arganians. And honestly, every time I start watching the episode, I'm like, why do we need the Arganians in season four?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or on the desktop iTunes app to get all the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to contact us. The best place is to join the larger conversation in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie on your network of choice. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And then you can go on over to the Nerd Party Network, and you can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing, familiar to people on this network, as the host of the 602 Club. And you can also find me co-hosting Great Shot Kid with you, Mike.
Yeah, you can find me over there on thenerdparty.com, and you can also find me right here on Trek.fm doing a show called The Edge. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Chris Steftenagle, Jeff Sutter, and Norman C. Lau. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Okay, well, I know this week I was rather critical about the accuracy of film projection or whatever. I will say that when I ran this movie, you know, as a projectionist, 99.9% of your job is just being super-duper paranoid and double-checking and triple-checking your work to make sure that you're not damaging any of these prints so that you're not, you know, making the prints look like they do in Grindhouse. But I really did sort of take the philosophy when running Grindhouse. I'm like, it doesn't matter, right? That's the whole point. So I'd thread it and walk away and not look back. That being said, I never damaged the print, but, you know, whatever.
Well, you're a professional.
Yeah. So anyway, as critical as we were, or as I was of the film presentation with Death Proof this week, I am going to be the 100% opposite next week in terms of film presentation when we talk about Quentin Tarantino's sixth movie, Inglourious Basterds.